Okay, recording's on. Topic six. We've had our week's break. And I guess I should admit that I was... Last night, I read the slides and I realised that I've completely forgotten what we've done in the last 5 weeks. After a little while, it came back to me. But in terms of, you know, when you look in your memory, you say, what have we done in the last 5 weeks? I'm just wondering if everyone else has got a faint feeling like that.
I tried to explain to my boyfriend this morning what I've been learning, and it was just impossible to get my head around it. So, I know every time I came back inspired by something, but I just could not tell you what we learned.
Yes, yes.
Can we maybe a recap? Everybody that does remember, say what they do remember?
Oh, that's shallow work.
Well, no, because I want to get through the lecture, I'm inclined not to do that, but I'm inclined to make a small kind of, I think the phrase is to speak to that, and it's to do with the material that we're getting into. It's not memorable. It's not like you're learning a bunch of facts. It's almost like every week we have to get into a certain space. And when we get in that certain space, it's almost like we're looking at the same thing again. Do you know each week we're almost looking at the same thing again? Husserl will have something new to say, which is a kind of a framework, but in this, essentially, the whole course we're looking at something that we've called transcendental subjectivity. And if you like, the whole point of the course is to, in some sense or other, make contact with what that means. And we're just finding different ways to make contact with something that we're calling transcendental subjectivity, but as a it's the place from which, if you like, our entire experience is emerging, and it's just not memorable. What's memorable appears in the world that's being projected. In a way, to understand what transcendental subjectivity is, you have to pull out of a certain frame of mind where you learn facts and you have memories of things, because transcendental subjectivity is always now. It operates now. The only way that you can actually have any contact with it is to become present. And if you become present, you sort of leave your memory behind. And you kind of enter a state where actually you don't really know anything memorably, but you are able to see stuff in the moment. So it's an entirely different place that we're looking at in this course to what you would ordinarily look at and you would ordinarily learn. And then what happens is you kind of, and I do this too, like last night, you fall back into another state of mind that has no understanding whatsoever of what we've been doing. And then somebody asks you, well, what's the course about? And you find you've got nothing to say. But there's a kind of a deeper...
There's a shift. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a reason for this. And in a way, because over the years I've been involved in similar situations where somebody who hasn't attended something like this asks, well, what was it all about? And you start explaining, and it all sort of sounds like it. Well, that either you don't understand it, or it wasn't about anything. But the gist of it really is that it's only really meaningful on the day, or when you're actually involved, say, really doing the reading, or you're actually engaged in it, and you can't kind of share it with somebody else unless they're doing it too. Do you know what I mean? Unless they, you know, this, it's not something that you can just sort of say, oh, well, what was on the 6 o'clock news? It's not something like that. Or if it is, then I haven't been doing it right. But I guess I'm just sort of saying it's like that for me too. Do you know? I have to get really into the zone of what we're talking about. And in my ordinary life, when I'm in the kitchen making the tea, you know, I'm not in the zone. This is relevant to today's class because Husserl is now going to explicitly talk about getting in that zone, and that's what he means by the epoche. And we're just approaching the epoche today. I've been promising it, and if we get to the end of the slides, we will get there. But again, it's almost like he's laying the ground. So let's do a bit more ground laying. And just for your kind of background as well, because I'm not sure how far I'm going to go into this, it turns out that this lecture, in a way, if you want to know the overarching kind of topic, it's about there being two worlds, a kind of immediate world of our experience, and then the scientific world, which has a kind of a and then being quite distinct. That would be maybe the centre of what we're looking at in this lecture. And we, in a way, we've been looking at it before with what does objectivism mean, but Husserl now wants to bring the fact that there's a split here. There's a certain way that we understand things scientifically, and there's a certain way that we understand things in our ordinary lives, and they're quite separate. And it just turns out, by the sort of synchronicity of things, that that's exactly what I'm writing about in the book that I'm working on at the moment. So this all ties in very nicely. But I guess the main thing for this lecture is to get a sense of what that means for each one of us, not as an abstract idea, because Husserl's speaking as a scientist in a way. I think for him, this scientific worldview was really deeply embedded in him, in a way that people who aren't scientists sort of encounter this scientific worldview more like something operating in the background in our culture. But I think it's not. Because I'd like to get something across in the class about this, about how this scientific worldview actually operates in everyone, even though if you were to go out in the street with a microphone and say, well, what do you think science is? You'd find that most people wouldn't really be able to explicate what science means. But that doesn't mean that it isn't shaping your, at a certain level, your understanding of the being of the universe. One of the things I've been working on in the book is to try and get that across, try and make it real. So maybe we can get through to some of that in this class. Again, because Husserl's dated as well, he's writing this in the 1930s, when I would say there was still a deep respect for science that's not so prevalent now. Anyway, let's look at what I've actually cut out here. So the idea of, I'm reading now for those of you listening on the recording, the idea of objective truth is predetermined by the contrast with the idea of truth in pre- and extra-scientific life. This latter truth has its ultimate and deepest source of verification in experience, in all its modes of perception, memory, etc. One must not inject into these words from current objective science any psychophysical, psychological interpretation. Above all, one must not go straight back to the supposedly immediately given sense data as if they were characteristic of the purely intuitive data of the life world. All right, so there's something to unpack there, I think, isn't there? Mm-hmm. In there. So he's saying something quite simple, really. When he's talking about the pre- and extra-scientific life and the being a source of verification, which he'll say again later, he's saying something like, what time is it? And it's 10:21. What I did there, right, was I picked up the phone and I looked and I saw what the time is. Is there a phone there? I look, I see, and there is a phone there. When he's talking about the source of verification in experience, he means that every moment we're able to verify all of the facts of perception. Everything that's going on in front of us, we don't have any serious questioning that there's a computer here, that there's a bottle here, that John's here, that the time was 10:21 when I looked at it. He's talking about that level of experience that we all live in all the time to get around in our daily lives. When he says it's a source of verification, and this is going to be pulled out more in the lecture, he means for scientists too. So somebody, a scientist who's actually engaged in some kind of scientific investigation, is still going to be reading a thermometer. Somebody working at CERN, looking at at the particles that are being shattered by the enormous energies that are being developed, they're still going to see the scatter on the photographic plate of the particles that were blown apart with their eyes. They're going to perceive what's on the plate with their ordinary perceptual experience of just, oh yeah, there's some dots there. The same perceptual level that we're working on all the time in our everyday life. So he's talking about something terribly simple when he talks about truth in pre and extra scientific life. We might not call it truth, but if you look at it, we're continually, if you like, experiencing the truth of the being, the things that there are around us, and many other kinds of truths too. The problem with our pre and extra scientific life is that level of perceptual truth blurs off into a whole lot of other things that people think are true that aren't true. We start to move off into our ideas, of what our political leaders are doing, how the country's running, what somebody thinks about us at work. There's something about our ordinary pre and extra scientific life where we believe an awful lot of stuff, and some of it's true and some of it isn't. But there's certainly a level, which I would say was just ordinary perception, a sort of a domain where we are in touch with something that we take to be true, and that isn't questioned by science either, because the people who are engaging in the experiments, living their life as scientists, also accept it to be true. So you've got a sense of what he means by that. Because the next paragraph is saying, because not a lot of people, when they think about this, do recognize what this simple, what he calls the life world, they don't really recognize the life world. The tendency is, especially with educated people, to already have a theory about what's going on in the life world, if you like. There's a sort of a... One of the things about phenomenology is encountering the life world, immediate experience as it is, and not understanding it through by means of a theory of some sort. So when he says any psychophysical or psychological interpretation, he means any already existing theory about the nature of our subjective experience. Because, like, the psychophysical theory is a kind of a reference to a dualism that says there's the material world and then there's your consciousness of it. The psycho is your sort of stream of consciousness, and the physical is the actual real reality. Do you know that that's already a theory that says there are these two things.
Yeah. So it's almost like so somebody that is scared of spiders will, spiders not a, I don't know, something that you're maybe have a phobia of.
Yeah.
So one person's saying somebody has a phobia of bottles. So you see one person sees the bottle and it's just that's a bottle. And that's their perception. And then somebody has a phobia and sees the bottle and just like has a really strong experience of it.
Yes.
So that sort of...
Yeah, well, now what we were talking about just, I was talking about just now, that's a demonstration, if you like, of where our subjectivity, we differ.
Yeah.
We differ about how we feel about objects.
But that doesn't change
yes.
the fact that that's the bottle.
Yes, yeah. But there's a level where you and I perceive the same bottle and we don't doubt it,
mm-hmm.
Even though you might have a kind of a feeling about plastic or about water or
mm-hmm.
you know that means that you start getting all kinds of other things going on,
mm-hmm.
there's still a ground, if you like, of agreement, which is how we're able to live our lives out here,
mm-hmm.
because if we didn't agree on those very basic perceptual aspects of life, we wouldn't be able to get to work at 9 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
you know, we wouldn't be able to run city clean, you know, we wouldn't be able to drive on the road without crashing. Do you know there's a level there where it definitely works, but as soon as people start to think about that, this is where we start becoming less factual, less perceptual, so and particularly in philosophy you start to think about what does it mean, what is going on. Clearly you're having a experience that's different to mine, and you've got a consciousness, I've got a consciousness, and it's all my consciousness is all full of colours and sounds and qualities like that, and when we look out into the world we don't find there are colours and sounds, we find there are photons and vibrating air molecules. So what's going on here? There's obviously a psychic consciousness, the realm of consciousness, there's a physical realm which we can trace everything that's happening in your consciousness back to actions that are happening in the physical world. There are clearly two worlds here. You see, as soon as you start turning, if you like, your objective scientific gaze onto things, you suddenly things start to split off, and you've got your psychological side and the physical side. And the tendency, we're looking at the second paragraph here, one of the early theories, and something that people still hold to, some people, is to say, well, how are we going to understand this, your stream of consciousness or your psychological experience? And if we objectively look at it, one way to understand it is to think that you're, in some way, you're having an experience of sense data. What you're experiencing is colour, which is a kind of visual sense data, and what you're experiencing is in sound is another kind of form of sense data that you're we're not doing it in this course, but one of the people that I tried to take apart in the other course was a German cognitive scientist and philosopher called Thomas Metzinger, who describes it as an ego tunnel, that we live in an ego tunnel. It's a kind of a movie that we project, and we not only if you see the walls of the tunnel are all of the colours and the sounds and the sensory qualities that we experience, but we also sort of project the being of somebody in the tunnel, and the whole thing for him is a kind of an illusion. I think you were.
He was quoting Anton Wilson's reality tunnel.
Yeah,
he's like he's changing it, because Anton Wilson's version of reality tunnel, that's it's sarcastic a bit. Everything he says is sarcastic. Anton Wilson.
Yes.
So Menzinger was quoting Anton Wilson's reality tunnel.
Yes.
Where Menzinger takes it and I think makes it very kind of rigid. And
well, for anyone who's interested, and if things go on for another 2 years of classes here, then not this year, but not 2020, 2021, I'll be back to Metzinger. I'll be doing that course again, I think. Or we'll have another look. But he's a great example of this kind of psychophysical split. Even though he's, you know, the fascinating thing about him is he's had out of body experiences. He meditates. He's got all the credentials of having really looked into consciousness and come up with a very scientific idea of what it all means. So one psychological interpretation of this is that what we're really experiencing is sense data, and in a way we don't really experience reality, because reality is out here in the physical world, the physical movement of atoms and molecules and energy fields. That's the real world, and we're experiencing a kind of sensory, it's not exactly an illusion, but representation of what's real, and what we experience is not really real. It's just related in a certain way. And then the question for psychology and a scientific understanding is, well, how are these two worlds related? How do they interact? Do you see? That's the framework within which science approaches human experience. And Husserl just wants to paint the picture of this is the situation, really, of our culture. Our culture has got this. I mean, it's in philosophy. If you go to study philosophy, then you, especially our Anglo-American kind of current philosophy, they've been agonizing over the mind-body problem or the mind-matter problem for since the scientific revolution almost. How do we take these two worlds and in some way or other explain them? And nobody's really managed it as yet. It's one of these outstanding people have presented ways that you can explain it. But there's been no kind of coherent agreement about this. So Husserl is saying, he's going to say it over and over, we must not think of experience in these terms. Not must not, but what he means by the life world is a place which we inhabit before we start thinking like that. Yes? We don't actually sit here and have a kind of an experience of here I am in my world of consciousness, but really there's another world out there of the real physical stuff. We don't actually live that way. It's only when you start to reflect and do philosophy, if you like, that you start to that these worlds separate from each other. Now, what Husserl's indicating is what he means by the life world is a world that precedes that separation, which we all live in our ordinary everyday life anyway. He means that without this kind of idea that it's something that's existing only in consciousness and there's some other world. But me projecting to the end of the lecture as well, you know, because that's the whole lecture is really walking around this. How do we understand these two worlds? So what is actually, I'm reading again now, what is actually first is the merely subjective relative intuition of pre-scientific world life. This merely has the disdainful colouring of the doxa. Doxa, I know we have a couple of people who might know they're Greek. Is Greek for opinion, I think, isn't it? To have a
yeah, in the ancient Greek, I guess, because nowadays the meaning is more related to glory. But I think
in ancient philosophy there was doxa and episteme, which was knowledge, and it was say Plato and even back to Parmenides, there was this idea that the ordinary people just have opinions, but philosophers have knowledge, and there's a sort of a distinction that science took over from that, that the ordinary person in the street just has opinions, but the scientist has true knowledge, which is considered to be true justified belief in that world of logic and analytical philosophy. A kind of example of that, in a way, a classical example of that, is that an ordinary person considers the sun rises in the morning. Here he comes, or here she comes, rising above the horizon. Whereas the scientist has the knowledge that the sun isn't rising, the earth is going round it. Do you see, that's the kind of epitome of when science says we just have a subjective relative experience of the world. It's like that. Our subjective relative experience, relative from where we stand, is that on the earth, is that the sun is rising, and that the earth is the centre of the universe. And this is the kind of a core example, because the scientific revolution arose out of, in a way, one of the key aspects of it was the realization that the earth goes around the sun. And it kind of almost represents the difference between what science gets the true picture. Although it seems to us that the sun's rising, the true picture is that the sun's not rising, the earth is going around it. Do you see, in a way, that's the epitome, if you like, of the sense that we don't really see things as they truly are. What you need is to do some science, to do some measurement, and then you can come to a proper understanding of what's going on. And it's a great example, because for hundreds, if not thousands of years, people have got it wrong. The response, by the way, back to that, is that it is true from how can I put this? Both views are true. It's entirely a matter of where you define the still point of the universe to be. Mm. Yes? If you take the sun to be at the still point, then the earth goes round it. Yes? But if you take yourself to be the still point, and you relate yourself to the earth, and you take the earth to be the still point, then the sun does rise. It does come up over the horizon. It's not a false thing to state. It's only false if you extend it further than what your immediate experience shows you. It's true, isn't it, that the sun rises up at the horizon. It's true. Do you see how language... gets you so easily mixed up. What's untrue is your projection of a certain model of the solar system. But in fact, when you see the sunrise, you're not projecting a model of the solar system. You're just watching the sunrise. So I'm saying all that so that, in a way, I was making a point, and now I've destroyed it. I should be doing a better job of defending the scientific view that our immediate experience is merely subjective relative, because that's what Husserl's driving at. This overarching opinion, but amongst scientists in particular, that ordinary experience is not to be relied upon. It needs to be clarified and perfected by means of scientific objective investigation. In pre-scientific life, our experience has nothing of this merely subjective relative about it. It is a realm of good verification based on well-verified predicative cognitions and truths which are just as secure as is necessary for the practical projects of life that determine their sense. I see a quick frown here and there. So you're in order to build a house, you have to have a true and correct perception of what you're doing and other things around you. That there are nails. That I've hammered a nail in and it's secured the wood sufficiently for the job that I'm doing. The entire building of a house can go and can progress entirely in this subjective relative domain that we're talking about. You don't need to become scientific about building a house. You don't need to. What would it mean to be scientific about building a house? You don't have to do. You don't have to think in terms of the molecular and atomic structure of the materials that you're dealing with.
Yes.
Getting out, using the hand, the door handle. In a way, there's a whole series of correct ideas that you have about the things around you that enable you to do the things that you do. You don't need to know about the. For instance, if you're cooking, you don't need to know about the molecular structure of the food that you're eating. Yes.
But you would never get to the point where you would cook, though, because you won't need to draw any conclusion about the things you interact with. Because if the truth is just as secure as is necessary for the practical projects of life, then if there was an already brick, I know bricks are a man-made, but if there was a stone then, actually, this is a stone, I can touch it, I'd have to draw a conclusion and say, well, if I stacked some stones together, I'd build a wall, and then a further conclusion would be, if I had some of those walls, I could probably support a roof.
Yes.
But without drawing a conclusion, and have some form of projection, then you'd never be in a position to do anything more complicated than interact with things as they are.
Yes. Yes.
But is there space for that there?
So I think with the ambiguity here is we're not quite clear exactly where dealing with ordinary life shades off into becoming science. Mm-hmm. Yes? But we did sort of look at that. It shades off into becoming science when we start to construct a mathematical model of what's going on. And then we, on the basis of having an entirely abstracted mathematical model of what's going on, we then make predictions on the basis of that model and then refer the model back to reality. So in a way, one way of thinking about being scientific is that we build a model of what's going on. And then in that model, we figure out what to do, and then we refer what to do back to our immediate experience. Whereas most of the time in our ordinary life, we don't need to build any such model. And you were starting to talk about, but we do envisage things. Mm. Yes, we go into our imagination and envisage something, but we still envisage things. In our subjective relative manner, you know, as you're planning to build the house, you're imagining stones. You haven't gone to some other level of mathematical abstraction. You're, in a way, your envisaging is all an envisaging that comes from your kind of hands, your physical experiential knowledge of the materials that you're dealing with. Mm. So, you know, you can go further. If you're building a building that you've never built before, and you might not know how strong a lintel to put in, you're on the verge of science there, right? Because if you don't know how strong the lintel is that you need to put in, then you need to start to figure out the underlying physical properties of the steel, let's say, or the stone that you're using, and then you start to refer to information or knowledge that science has worked out about the properties of materials, whereas before that, preceding that kind of scientific kind of approach, there would have been a bit of trial and error and death. I remember when we put that lintel in, it fell down, didn't it? So probably you should make it a bit thicker.
But yeah. To draw that conclusion, yes. Though, is that a scientific conclusion because you've had the experiment?
No, I don't think you can. The fact that you draw conclusions is something that we naturally do in this subjective relative world. I think that when you look into how it operates, that that foreseeing of what will happen is what we're talking about. And the foreseeing of what will happen is actually operating all the time. So I was talking before, as my hand moves towards the phone, there's a foreseeing of what will happen, sort of implicit in everything that I do, without thinking about it. But when we do think about it, we start to just take some kind of ability that's already there. It's this one, I'm sorry if that spoiled the recording, but there was a foreseeing, which is almost an induction from previous experience, that's going on all the time. Something has figured out the best way to get out of the room, but you haven't. If you need to, I'll probably go that way. I don't know why, but something's already in a way ahead of me. That's making plans, and it's a similar thing when you start to build something, except that you move into this other level where you're doing it in your imagination. But that still isn't science.
But isn't that a central, the essence of science? Like of scientific thinking, being able to draw conclusions? This is...
No, I think, when I say no, we're on a ground here where it's not like there's a stone in the sky which is written, this is the essence of scientific thinking. So when I say no, I'd say that's not how I see it, would be a better way to put it. Because there is a lot of debate, if you like, about what it means to be scientific. For me, after looking at it for quite a long time and not seeing to begin with what it was, I've come to see that what distinguishes our kind of science, this is a better way to put it, it's because there's a sense that I think is correct, that science doesn't have to be mathematical in the way that we practice it. I think the idea of science is bigger than that. The idea of science is really, in some way, an impulse towards having some kind of true knowledge of things. And that doesn't have to be a mathematical knowledge of things. But the science that Husserl's talking about is mathematical science. If you remember at the beginning of the crisis, there was a section which I just didn't discuss because I said I talked about it in another class, all about Galilean science. Remember we were talking about triangles, I don't know if you were... Yes. That the thing that characterises modern science is this transposition of experience into a mathematical dimension. That where we say, well, what's the only thing that we can be absolutely sure of, that we can truly rely on, is what we can measure. And as soon as you say that that's what's the absolutely reliable, true and real world, you see you've become mathematical. Because what you can measure takes you into the domain of number, arithmetic, geometry, and you've moved from immediate experience into an abstract realm, because mathematics is an abstract realm, and then you develop your theories of what is in that mathematical realm, so that you end up with Newton's law of gravity, for example. You know, that was, the, if you like, the first great kind of God. He's discovered what God's design for the universe. But in a way, that was the beginning of our kind of science, our modern kind of science, which thinks that really what we're looking at, what we dream of, particularly in physics, is a perfect mathematical description of how things are. It might not look mathematical because of the way it's taught at school. So it doesn't look mathematical because when you're taught science, you're the only way people can get the ideas across is to get you to imagine things, picture things, which is in a way transposing the mathematics back into your intuitive, relative human subjectivity. So you think of atoms as, you know, this is how I did, as little things with billiard balls going around them, billiard balls in the middle, when in fact it's the science itself has no idea what they are. That's just us picturing it. All the science itself has to say is that we've discovered certain mathematical relationships here that enable us to predict what will happen in the world of our experience. But really, what lies underneath it is a pure mathematical description of things that we then, when we learn science, we picture. We have a little intuitive picture of what that mathematics might mean. But as you're probably aware, when you get down to quantum physics, you can't even picture it anymore now. You know, so we're in the. Was that a good? I'm not sure that I quite hit what you were asking.
So you're saying the ability to predict is not part of our scientific thinking, but part of our pre-scientific thinking.
Yes, but it's obviously passes over into that.
Yes.
I mean,
you cannot imagine how.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the because my own understanding of science, not the cells, is that there's a certain our perception of the world is a continuous prediction, and it is the same prediction that science is using, but it's been taken into another dimension, an abstract dimension. Yes, Wes.
For just a second.
Yes.
We're doing the Learning Centre Awards here on the 19th November at 1:30. If anyone's interested in getting involved for coming through the Centre of Learning, let me know. And it's presented by the Lord Lieutenant of East Sussex, who's the Queen's representative. I do understand it's not everyone's cup of tea, but if you're interested, come and see me. It's the Centre Awards, not the public.
Just a question, this radiator doesn't seem to be on. Is there a trick that we need to do?
Turn it on.
No. Is it not on? Because I thought it was.
It's not so cold.
I thought it was on briefly. When I came in, I seemed to. It
no,
seemed to
be.
Okay. Did you didn't turn it off, did you, John?
No.
Is it the.
It was on four.
Oh, like
maybe it's just got a thermostat that's.
It's making a
sound.
We used to have a little stand-up one that we used
last season.
That helped
support the meeting. Remember?
Some noise now.
Is it the nice thing
that
for us?
No,
that one, is
that
one? Yeah, that's working, that one. Yeah.
Oh,
I remember last year, Rose, we had
work.
A...
Thank you, Wes.
Let me know.
What was the trick? What happened?
Turned it off and turned it on.
Turn it off and turn it on.
The old, I think, everything.
Yeah.
DVDs.
Yeah.
Now, fires used to be... It didn't used to work like that. I'm sure there must be a... Must be some... Some... I think there might be some thermostat that's malfunctioning.
Yeah.
Maybe you have to keep doing
that
it.
One doesn't always, I've noticed that before, it doesn't always come on.
But they...
Good.
So, I'm going to move on. Because Husserl keeps making the same point here, that there are two worlds here. And we have to think about them correctly. And the whole lecture really is about trying to draw this distinction. Let me try and put it this way, because I'm still answering your question in a way. It's sort of going back to Newtonian science. If you want to understand, you know, I hold something and I drop it. At the subjective, relative, ordinary consciousness, everyday level, you just see it. You hold it, you drop it, and it falls. And we can even get a sense that it starts to get faster and faster as it falls. You know, if you just drop it that far, it doesn't break. If you drop it from a really big height and it's something that will break, at a certain point it'll smash because it gets faster and faster and faster as it goes down. And we would, in a way, if we were being subjective relative, we'd learn basically that something like that's happening, and we'd say, well, if I'm going to drop this, I better not drop it from, just by trial and error, from higher than, you know, a couple of feet, otherwise it'll break. But then the sort of step into being scientific is to say, well, actually, I've got a formula here where I can work out exactly how fast it's going to fall. But first I have to weigh it and work out the mass, and I might even have to work out the density if there's any kind of air friction. And then I can plug all that into a formula that'll work out exactly the speed with which it will fall. And then I can have another. I can actually calculate how rigid the body is, and I can get a kind of a numeric measure of the rigidity and the strength, the tensile strength of the body, and I can calculate that body, if I drop it, it will actually smash at an exact point, 15.7 centimeters. If I drop it 15.7 centimetres or greater, it will smash. And I can do all of that without, once the physics is in place, without even having to drop the thing.
But that's the thing. In order for physics to be in place, but in order to get there, to this formula, you need this type of trial and error. And this is part of science, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And in a way, you're actually just saying what Husserl's saying at the bottom there, which is that the entire endeavour of finding out that formula was a trial and error, subjective, relative thing that happened in our...
So this is not part of science, it's part of our...
Well, no, we're ahead in the lecture, because Husserl's saying, well, yeah, this is part of science, but science itself doesn't recognise it.
Okay.
Yes? Science thinks that there's a pure scientific thinking tends to disregard the fact that all of science is occurring courtesy of our ordinary experience, because it's got a kind of a philosophical understanding that the world that is being uncovered by scientific investigation is more real than our subjective relative world, and not just more real, but that everything that occurs in our subjective relative world is caused by this deeper world that science is uncovering, that it's that there's a causal direction that says your experience is a kind of irrelevant. I think we spoke about epiphenomenalism at some point in the course, didn't we? Yeah. The fact you're having an experience is having no effect whatsoever on the behaviour of the matter. It's just a kind of fizz that comes off, a kind of a the picture I have is that your whole life is you're just in a train carriage. You're looking out the window, you know, and you can't. There's nothing you can do about it. Even your fact you think you can do something about it is all part of what you see in the window. But we won't go into epiphenomenalism. We're going to being in itself, which is partly what I was just talking about. The subjective relative is supposed to be overcome by objective science. One can and should, if one's a scientist, correlate it with a hypothetical being in itself. This being in itself is the being of the purely material, the purely causatively effective material stuff, which is a substrate for logical mathematical truths in themselves that one can approximate through ever newer and better hypothetical approaches, always justifying them through experiential verification. So the substrate, the idea of a substrate, is the idea that science has that this material world that it's investigating mathematically is the foundation, that's what a substrate is, of our experience. That it, in some sense, it's the prior, it's the a priori, it's the original and the real out of which our experience is emerging. And not only that, that it's it has the true being, but we can't experience it directly. All that we can experience directly is this subjective relative world of consciousness. This isn't my view, this isn't Husserl's view, this is the, if you like, the standard view of science that we've inherited from the scientific revolution. And we have to be careful here. It's not that all scientists believe this. In fact, a lot of scientists don't even think about it. And it's not that all philosophers believe this, but it's an idea that's embedded in our culture. So do you see the... There's an idea that what I'm seeing here is a kind of a subjective surface of the and the real table is really made of atoms and molecules and electromagnetic energy that is inaccessible to me in my sensory world, but not inaccessible to my scientific inquiry. But my scientific inquiry is such that all I can actually find out about that substrate are mathematical truths. Do you see? It's just impossible for me to actually experience it itself. I could never find out what a photon looks like, for instance, because a photon, the only way you can ever detect a photon is because something else has bounced off it. And that hits your retina and then something happens in your brain and you have an experience. Yes? But you can never actually experience the photon itself, but you can measure it. And it appears, if you like, in your mathematical understanding of the true nature of reality. It's quite important that you see this structure, because it's this structure, this scientific understanding. This is the engine that we. It's like the handle that we turn as soon as we want to do something here on this earth, as soon as we want to develop some kind of technology to solve our problems, or to develop a new weapon, or to develop a better communication strategy, or to develop sustainable energy, or to ...
AI.
Artificial intelligence. As soon as I'd like you to see why is it important. It's because our entire response to our situation here is technological. We're engaged in a kind of a process of trying to make our lives, to begin with, just better, and now we're trying to engage in a process of trying to just keep things going. We don't even really want to make, by making things better, I mean getting enough food on the table, decent housing. You know, the first ambitions in the Industrial Revolution were just that, let's say, everyone in England, maybe Scotland if we were being generous, possibly Wales, certainly not Ireland, would be able to get enough food and decent housing, and maybe we could tackle a few of the plagues and epidemics. You know, this is what science, if you like, this kind of mathematical science, that was its domain, and it's achieved that. Not for the whole earth, obviously. But now it's created its own problems. Do you see? Most of the problems that we face now, like global warming, you know, nuclear weapons, mass destruction, overpopulation even, is a matter of our agriculture having become scientific. Nearly all the problems we face are a result of our scientific objectivity and the technology that it's built. And our response to that is still to build more technology. We're still in the same cycle. We don't really deeply question the whole approach. We at a certain level we still think that the reason that we're in such a bad state is because we haven't been scientific enough. We haven't been rational enough. The reason we're in such a state is because of this stupid subjective relativity of all the greedy, ignorant people. I mean, do you recognise this sort of frame of thinking? If only the humans could stop being so vindictive to each other. If only people could be more rational and honest and not tell lies and not try and manipulate and deceive each other. That's still coming out of the scientific revolution, the idea that this kind of scientific rationality is going to be able to fix everything. And the fact that it's caused a whole mass of terrible problems for us is not the fault of scientific rationality or the technology that it's produced. It's the fault of the human beings who haven't been rational enough. I'm going into that because I'm trying to bed down the fact that it matters. It's in us, this scientific rationality.
True apple, an apple that's grown without like chemical stuff.
Yes.
It just shoots out all these associations and meanings. Yeah, or pomegranate. But when you get an apple, there's art, maybe greenhouses. You don't get any meanings, as much meanings as true apple. Like in terms of associations, and so you live in more and more into a meaningless kind of experiences.
Well, yes. Yes, that's the. I mean, you're sort of moving me to say something about one of the problems of this scientific rational approach to everything, that still thinks that the reason that it's not working on the humans is that they're not rational enough, is that the view of the world that is embedded into that approach is absolutely devoid of meaning. Because if you like, meaning dwells within human subjectivity. It dwells in the subjective relative, and the scientific technological approach is a kind of has sidelined that subjective relative world of where we poor humans are saying things like, well, what's the meaning of it all? Why are we here? Why am I feeling so depressed living in this technological desert? You know, it's...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, when you see even children when they're eating this meaningless apple, you feel sorry for them, right? You're like, oh no, you don't know what
yeah.
a true apple is.
But, I mean, you're just reminding me, because I've been reading Jung again, do you know that once upon a time, we put science to one side, the apple growing on the tree and you is a miracle. Do you know that you know the sense of the feeling of that it's come out of the earth. It's an expression of the earth that's grown and appeared on this tree as a kind of a gift from the mother. And as do you see the context of what an apple would mean? In the background, in our understanding of things, it's nothing of the sort. It's just a whole bunch of atoms and molecules that were just kind of thrown together by accident. But because of certain kinds of propensities, I mean, I don't want to go into it, but the science is working on it, for self-organization that's inherent in these meaningless atoms and molecules, there was a possibility that atoms and formed molecules, and then molecules were self-replicating, and as they started to self-replicate entirely by accident, they formed a living cell. Not really living, it's just a kind of a machine, a self-replicating cell machine, and then these self-replicating cell machines joined together form multicellular replicating machines that then join together, and the theory of evolution, yada yada yada, we get a tree, we get an apple, it doesn't mean a thing. Do you see the whole story in science is deeply embedded in our culture, and also deeply embedded in a kind of a sense that we don't have any meaningful account of why we are here. Of course, you can become a Christian, you can become a Mohammedan, you can join a religion, you can become a philosopher and you can make one up for yourself. But essentially, as a culture, collectively, we have no sense of the meaning or the purpose of our existence and our being here. What we have is this scientific story. What we have is the theory of evolution. That's in the background where you fall back on it. That's lurking there. And partly what I'm on a roll now. Partly that's what I mean by you go up to someone in the street and you say, well, talk to me, tell me about your understanding of science. They're not necessarily going to be able to give you an account. But somewhere in the background, there will be this sense of this absence of a true myth or a true meaning to the way that we're living here is felt by everyone. It's a background. I think everyone.
Collective.
Yes.
Unconscious or subconscious.
Yes, but it's not even unconscious. Do you know? I would say that the sort of mental health issues that are in our society. Have got many. It's complex, but I think it's connected to this.
Yeah, I think so. Because all the time that you were talking, I kept going. Husserl's saying there are these two worlds, but actually, for a lot of people, if you went up to the person in the street and said, "What do you think of science?" They say, "Well, I don't think much, but I love music," or "I love." They would start perhaps talking about something else that was a third world by this way of looking at it, which is subjective to them, but which is coming out of another reality that we could even get, say, when Huxley took his LSD or mushrooms and he started looking at the table as divine. He could see another whole world coming out of all the objects around him that was the normal person wasn't seeing either, and the scientists couldn't measure.
Yes.
So when you just put it into two,
yes,
and talk about somebody on the street, then they could completely miss that scientific level, but go to a much more poetic level, refined level, and also appreciate the table as it is, and design a table themselves without knowing any of the science. So the science is sort of caught in the middle, isn't it?
Although I'm...
Yes. I mean, I don't know that AI thing is that we're going to be... that we will be... AI will take us over.
Hmm.
And that we'll just make ourselves extinct. Not in our lifetimes, but that...
Hmm.
I really think that's a real reality, that not just a movie, but a true reality that's going on behind the scenes with Google and the whole... Not the same, you know, but that's how it's going to go. You know, unless something stops that or something intervenes where it can't happen, I think that's the most, for me as a peer, is the most frightening thing. That it won't happen in my lifetime, it might not happen in the next generation, but in a few generations, that we are going to something, or it's just not going to work. But the sense of it is that the most scariest thing is that us as human beings here, living a crazy, whatever life we live, is not going to be here, and that we're not me personally, but you know, as a species, we're going to make ourselves extinct, unless something from the outside makes us extinct, or some other catastrophe stops it all. I mean, I just really get scared of that myself, but that's how that the science is getting so clever and so, you know, out there, that there won't be a human being. I mean, that's, if people say that we're all just, what's his name, James Lovelock, you know, that we'll just be, AI will just be our the way out.
Can I just, I wanted to say one thing to John there, which is almost looking ahead in the lecture, which is it's not that Husserl is saying there are two worlds, finally or ultimately, because I think in a way he's going to say, well, actually, the scientific world is in the life world. The moment we're looking at science from science's place, and it's when you think scientifically that you end up with this secondary world, and if you like, from science's perspective, the third world you're talking about is just part of the non-scientific. It's part of the subjective.
Yeah.
Whereas,
well, it would have to be for that. Yeah.
I think if we do well at the end of this lecture, we will arrive at the fact that we don't really understand anything. Do you know that this idea that there are two worlds is just an idea? In a way, phenomenologically speaking, the only ground we have is the ground of our immediate experience, and that's always unified. We don't really ever encounter two worlds. We just encounter different states of consciousness, which in a sense is always unified. Do you know this idea of two worlds, which is the way science is viewing things? There's a level here where we can settle down and say, but it is only an idea. Do you see where it's a way of picturing things? And the reality is that we actually are here in the life world picturing that there are two worlds. But you never actually ever leave the life world. Yes? And in a way that's a kind of what Nicolette's mentioning about there's a sort of a, I don't know if you're aware of this, because it's my area, so I think everyone's aware of it, but there's this idea of the singularity. Have I spoken about that?
That's Kurzweil, isn't it?
Well, he's picked up on it, but I forget who first proposed it. I don't think it was him. But it's the idea that this sort of what we call computation intelligence is going to pretty soon, not sure how long, 20. So it, generally the prediction that people make is always after they've retired. So that they're not actually out of work to be caught when they say, oh, it didn't happen. Because, you know, people have been predicting that computers are going to become super intelligent. Alan Turing, who was really the pioneer in the whole area, thought it would occur around the year 2000. So he's wrong still. His computers aren't super intelligent, but the idea of the singularity is that we're going to figure out how the brain works as a physical device, if you like. We're going to figure it out. Given time, we'll figure it out. And as soon as we've figured it out, the basic principles on which it works will be, it's more than likely going to be possible to implement that in silicon. Which means, instead of things operating maybe at a few hundred meters per second, it'll be operating at near light speeds. It means that instead of having a brain that has to be the size that will fit through a human body to be born, it could be almost arbitrarily as large as you like. And you would, if you've managed to build such a brain, once you've trained it, you only need to train it once. You don't need to build another one and have a childhood for that. Once one of those electronic devices has figured out how to walk, how to talk, how to everything that a human might be able to do and more, you don't need children to spend another 10, 20 years to learn it. You immediately replicate as many as you like that have immediately got that ability. And not only that, if we've got a brain like that, brain, I'm putting it in quotes, one of the first things that we would ask it to do is to build a better brain.
It's the last human invention, isn't it? Intelligence.
Build a better brain. And not only that, you could build a better brain in your own memory. It's a simulation. You actually have to build it. It just be a piece of software, in it, if you like. Although there might be some new hardware that it thinks of. You build a better brain, and the first thing you ask that brain to do is build a better brain. And after you get on a kind of an exponential liftoff, which means once you've got to human-level intelligence, very quickly, and if it's done in software, it could be in a matter of hours, you're going to have an intelligence that completely transcends anything that the human brain is capable of. And I guess the next point is, if you're not Rasputin, you know, if you're the Russian president and you have such a device at your disposal, it's going to out-trade, out-compete, out-spy. It's going to be as a weapon, an intellectual weapon, in its ability to completely overtake the information systems of everybody else on Earth. It's going to do that almost immediately. So somebody having got such a device, they're not going to use it, because it's just like the atom bomb. Because the other, we've got to have it too, right? Because if we don't have it, we're not going to be able to stop the other people utterly dominating us. But then, the next thought is that these super intelligences are going to get together and figure out how stupid we are. That's Nicolette's concern. That's the concern that people actually now in the area are taking seriously. It's not just a science fiction thing. That people are going, we better do something about this before it's too late. Yes.
And first, yeah, and so I guess in a way that so it's possible that all of that happens, but the one thing that these, you know, I guess they would be robots, would have, or whatever they're called, they don't have subjectivity.
Yeah. Although there's going to be...
And not saying that this subjectivity is a good thing, you know, but that was something that you can never fake. Yeah, you can never fake that.
So there are people who think, Alan Turing was one of them, that it's impossible to say. How could you say? It's I think the phrase is if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then it's a duck. You know, this could easily look like a duck and quack like a duck. As in, it would if it was needed to. One of the things it would pretty soon figure out would be how to make a human being think that I'm a human being,
mm-hmm.
right? So it should be able to, if it's got that computing power behind it, it should be able to absolutely convincingly simulate the fact to you that I'm just as conscious as you are.
But there is a really great episode of Black Mirror about exactly that. This woman recreates a guy based on his Facebook data, blah, blah, blah. But what I think there, for example, a memory, you can, you know, I guess you could upload a fake memory, but a memory will have emotions, and you will have to have felt those emotions because they shape you. And so, you know, I think perhaps we could be fooled to an extent, but there will always be a point where you can't have a conversation with such a thing. You know, it's like, oh, you know, tell me about your childhood.
Well, they...
You might say, oh, yeah, this and that happened, or, you know, my dad beat me and it was bad. But there will not, you know, that's I don't know, that will be a known memory, but that might not be... something that actually shaped them, and I think that would feel insincere.
So, it's quite, if we can just dwell on this a little bit,
mm-hmm.
A kind of a super artificial intelligence. If it set itself the task of simulating the expression of an emotion,
mm-hmm.
it would be able to study. Given it's a super intelligence, every single aspect of what's happening in your nervous system when you experience an emotion,
mm-hmm.
yeah, right down to the, you know, the molecular level, if you like, and how it makes the muscles of your face change,
mm-hmm.
and how you know what happens to your eyes, the sound of your voice, it could all be simulated, so that it would be impossible in any physical way to distinguish between that thing that's simulating an emotion and you. I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're saying, but somewhere, because you're a human subjectivity,
mm-hmm.
and there's something like an inner feeling in you, you would know that it was fake.
Yeah.
Yes.
So say like,
because it mimics
yes.
it. It doesn't
yes.
have... a desire, for example, it can mimic someone who has a desire.
Yes.
But the machine, how could a machine have a desire?
But if it did it perfectly, which is what we're saying, it can do it perfectly. I think somewhere here, if you're absolutely conscious and absolutely present, you would recognize. We don't have such a machine, so I'm just imagining this. You would recognize a terrible void behind it.
Yes.
But...
the void of the soul.
Yes. But how many people
mm-hmm.
are conscious in that way?
Not many. I mean, some people walk around
yes,
and already
yes,
be
care about.
These beings
yes.
when you talk to them. But
how many people have spent almost their entire lives now interacting with... With pixels on a screen, because you see, I'm pretty sure that if it came down to somebody, a perfect simulation of me on Skype or me on Skype, you probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference. I think you'd actually have to have me here in the room to be able to say, oh, yeah, yeah, that really is John. Yes.
And so, for example, I mean, this being might be, you know, aware that if their dad died in their childhood, that would be sad, but they would be taught that. So a human being might have had their dad die and it was actually not sad, but a good thing. So, you know, that would be their experience where this thing would be taught, oh, dad died, probably a bad thing, sadness. Do you know what I mean? So
no, I have to sort of indicate there's a deeper level of horror in here, which is that the super intelligent machine will understand exactly how your nervous system works. So it will know what it's like to be beaten in terms of what that does to a nervous system. It'll know what it's like to have a bad father in terms of how that reconfigures the connections in your brain and the neurons and your behavioural responses. So when I talk about it, it wouldn't have to teach it what it was like. It would figure it out by knowing everything there is to know about physical nervous systems.
But certain things, you know, so for example, a father dying in childhood. Sorry, I learned that piece of education. So if the father dies in early childhood, for some that might have been a godsend, and for some that's a traumatic experience.
And let me say now.
Yeah.
So I am this super intelligence now. I'm saying, yeah. Well, bring me someone who it was a good experience. Bring me someone who's a bad experience. I'm going to do the scan. Mm-hmm. Got it. I see the difference. I see the fit. There's going to be a physical difference between the nervous systems. Mm-hmm. And once I've figured that out, I know all there is to know.
I think they will have to learn from us. So let's say that they would have to see my brain,
yeah,
and see, or if my father died and I was happy, and somebody who, yeah, so scan it through myself. So not just learning by itself, but seeing through.
But then they would still have to also make a decision of which one it is going to be.
Yeah.
So because, yeah, it, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's a possible to fully recreate a human.
Remember too that it too will have a totally complete understanding of what it is to be a human brain, the structure of the architecture, and that a totally complete understanding of the nervous system, of how hormones work,
yeah,
of how neurotransmitters work. The whole thing will have just. Yes, it'll know all that.
That's what I'm trying to get at, is that all of that is possible, and yet the sort of, I mean, if I got it right, but the sort of transcendental subjectivity is not possible for it.
That's the kind of key. That's almost why we're studying this course, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the human race has some kind of consciousness of what it is to be conscious, they're not... I guess I have to say we.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to include myself somehow. We're just going to, like Nicolette said, doesn't mean we don't necessarily have to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to forget what it is to be conscious. We're going to we're going to live in a world where we no longer are able to distinguish ourselves from machines, and at a certain level we're going to come to believe that we are machines, and there are already people, highly educated people, who think like that already. It's at the back of this, there's something terribly bleak. There's at the back of it, you would say, okay, all right, so didn't work out well on Earth. We'll try another planet.
That makes me feel very hopeful that despite all of these possibilities, I feel that it is this specific thing, you know, I guess that would be transcendental subjectivity, that sets us apart and that is more than.
Yes.
There may be some integrity somewhere that might hold it.
that we can't know, but there may be some human integrity that it won't go that way.
It's almost like, for me, I guess it's sort of the idea of a soul that will not, is not possible to recreate because it's not a thing. It's
and
like
what's
a,
the point? I mean, we're
doing
this beautiful earth, and then we just kind of make those machines that...
Replaces.
It seems completely,
exactly.
It does seem mad.
It's
I mean,
mad.
So
it is mad.
Sense, when
yes.
you see it and you look at it and you think, God, it seems mad. Why would we do that?
Yeah.
We're given this. We're given
we
this
have
life.
All everything we need already.
Just,
yeah.
I've given just this an amazing life here, no matter what muddle we've made of it, but it's still, we've given it. And then... I mean, why would you want to do that? I just can't see, you know. I mean, I can see why you'd want to make a bionic arm and why you want to cure cancer.
Yeah.
I can, you know, and it's amazing what we've done.
I think it's similar. Well, the reason is probably it's the pursuit of meaning, isn't it? Because especially, it's sort of similar to the allegory of the apple, in that we've destroyed the meaning of the apple. So we have nothing to replace that with. All we have is the impetus to go forward and to discover meaning, and so we create some sort of machines to try and do that. That's just an expression of that will,
yeah.
I think.
I don't know. But it's already... The other thing, kind of like now, is that everyone is in the computer. You know, like kids are just completely... You know, unless you keep them under control, they're just completely immersed in the computer, you know. I mean, I was, you know, I was not here, you know, we were, I wasn't brought up with the computers, but I've worked with kids, you know, they're just completely immersed in it.
But not yet completely.
Not
I mean,
completely,
surely
no.
Surely there is
no,
certain things that will go and
I'm
touch the sense of humanness, regardless of their time.
But that was
so fine, didn't it? So one quick thing I'd say about this is that well, two things. One is that we have a kind of an illusion that we're in control, and in fact our technological will here is just a part of the human psyche, and I would pull Jung into this. I think if we go too far down that road, there's going to be a mighty reaction. It hasn't come yet, but I think there's going to be a mighty reaction, and it's not going to be a rational, thought out. This will be a sensible thing to do. It's because it's our rationality. If it goes too far, which seems to be, my prediction isn't that we're going to become absolutely lost in that world. I think the human psyche, the greater psyche, if you like, is going to overthrow it, and we're going to experience that as something awful and terrible, and the breakdown of our civilization and all the rest of it. But in the bigger picture, it was better than what was going to happen otherwise. Do you know that? That's the sort of picture I get. I mean, the other way is that the light bulbs start going on, and we say, well, what are we doing this for? Why are we building technology to replace ourselves?
Well, we're just going to destroy the earth so much that we have more important things to think about than recreating us artificially.
Yeah.
Do you think that when you sleep in a park, you see stuff grow on you? Ants come and build colonies, spiders build colonies, and stuff are built on you. I think that when a human allowed to other systems to be built on the human is when this technological progress happened. When that, who's making, are not individuals who are making technological progress, are bodies created by humans that are taking the lead in creating these things. And a human as an individual does not have control over these bodies. So you need to create a body in order to prevent these bodies, say, I don't know, NASA, to take the lead on technological progress. So I think unless the individual, you know, I don't know how it is for an individual to prevent these systems to grow on, to become part of these systems.
Yes. So, I guess we've spoken our way into a break, haven't we? Yes. So, second half, I'm going to try and get through these slides, if we can. Yes. I thought that was a sort of significant digression into this idea of the machines coming to take us over, because it's very relevant to what Husserl's talking about science back in mid 1930s. Mm-hmm. If you like, the science of today is very much concerned with technological progress, which is concerned with artificial intelligence, which holds this deep sense of a scientific understanding of who we are, that we're just in kind of substandard computers, and that we're going to build, you know, because the people who are in the technology, that's how they think. They think we're substandard computers, and we're just going to build better ones. And Kurzweil is thinking that way. Basically, his thinking is that that was our purpose, to come here and to build machines that are better than we are. That's evolution. And the fact we aren't here anymore, that's all right, because they'll be the suit, that dream of that Husserl was pointing to, of the triumph of rationality, the ultimately completely rational world. We're going to build computers who are going to create that world, and we won't be able to live in it because we weren't rational enough. All right. Bye.